torture, namely a reduced sentence because of the admission around his brutal torture, and open testimony where he could speak to the public, to his family who saw him for the first time, and to military officials who were utterly repulsed by the conduct of the United States government.
So tell us what happened to him and the number of cases you represented around him.
Well, he was one of a number of what the CIA called high-value detainees who were, you know, spirited to one of the numerous overseas secret detention sites, subject to CIA superintendents and interrogation, and tortured and tortured and tortured, even as he was sharing information and cooperating. They believed in the perverse logic of this authoritarian regime. That was only proof that he had more information to give. And then he was ultimately transferred to Guantanamo in 2006 after the Supreme Court intimated that holding people in secret CIA detention would violate the Geneva Conventions. So at that point, the Center for Constitutional Rights chose to represent him among, nearly two dozen other detainees in different parts of the U.S. detention program. And he and his lawyers fought consistently to get some sort of recognition and documentation about his torture. And over again, a little bit more of the iceberg was revealed. And as much as he was able to share, it's still just the top part of the iceberg. The Senate Select Intelligence Report regarding torture hasn't been fully declassified. We need to hear from other victims of the CIA torture program, and we need more meaningful accountability for what the United States government did to Majid and many dozens of other detainees in the so-called global war on terror.
Majid accused CIA medics of raping him through rectal feeding.
Yeah, that's been documented. And there's a level of sadism here that happened when the United States abandoned any commitment to legal constraint and turned over. I mean, I think what's interesting here is that this is the U.S. military jurors selected from the United States military expressing revulsion for the conduct of civilians who ordered the torture, namely Rumsfeld, Cheney, Bush, John Yoo, and other like repellent, so far unaccountable individuals from the Bush administration, judging them for violating basic legal and humanitarian norms.
Bob Rasmi, we just really have 30 seconds.
Yeah.
It is expected Majid will be released in February. 38 men will remain at Guantanamo? What is the Biden administration doing? Are they going to close Guantanamo?
I think they are supposedly working behind the scenes, but they need to do far more to ensure the safe release and transfer of all 38 detainees, including Majid Khan. And in his case, to be sent to a place where he's free, will have emotional and psychological support and connection to his family.
Well, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Bahar Azmi, legal director of the Center for Constitutional Rights. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is currently accepting application for a director of finance administration, also a human resources manager. Check it out at democracynow.org. And stay with us throughout these 2 weeks. Democracy Now! Is your place for the UN Climate Summit and everywhere around the world. I'm Amy Goodman.
Mark G. of the Evolution Control Committee, and you're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh, where the drunken pants are going wild.
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we talk with the author of Democracy in Chains, The Deep History of the Radical Right's Stealth Plan for America.
Nancy McClain puts it all together. This is like a evolving coup that's going on now. The bad guys are halfway there.
The Federalist Society has shifted the United States political and legal landscape to the right. Joining us today is Michael Avery, attorney and author of The Federalist Society, How Conservatives Took the Law Back from Liberals. He'll tell us how this happened. Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
The spectacle of Donald Trump and the palace intrigue in the White House has served daily to distract people from the political strategy and accomplishments of the radical right, which is taking over the Republican Party. Over time, the GOP has been transformed into an operation conducting a concerted effort to curb democratic rule in favor of capitalist interests in every branch of the government, whatever the consequences. It is marching ever closer to the ultimate goal of reshaping our Constitution to protect moneyed interests. This gradual takeover of a major political party happened steadily over several decades and often in plain sight. Duke Professor Nancy McClain exposes the architecture of this change and its ultimate aim. She has written that, quote, both my research and my observations as a citizen lead me to believe American democracy is in peril. Her book, Democracy in Chains, The Deep History of the Radical Right's Stealth Plan for America, has become an intellectual flashpoint and caused her to become the victim of a coordinated right-wing attack. She tells the long-overlooked story of James Buchanan, the political economist who developed the playbook for Charles Koch and his brother and their web of billionaires and millionaires who, beginning in the mid-2000s, have become a force to reckon with. To talk about the subversion of our democratic system from within is Professor Nancy McClain.
Nancy McClain, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. I'm happy to be with you.
The Republican Party has been transformed both locally and nationally. It's no longer the party that, as you wrote, my father used to vote for. Today we're hoping to explore how the Republican Party has become an instrument of the far right. You argue that key to this story, what you call the missing piece, is understanding the rise of the billionaire radical right and its radical impact on our politics. There's a man named James McGill Buchanan. Tell us about him and how you learned about him.
Yes, well, what I learned is that James McGill Buchanan's ideas are what enabled Charles Koch to break through in his quest for radical transformation of our institutions after decades of pretty much ineffectual work on the margins. James McGill Buchanan was the first Nobel Prize winner to have been born in the U.S. South and to have worked most of his life in Southern institutions. He was the founder of a new school of thought called public choice economics, which is actually a broader tradition that includes people like Cass Sunstein, who worked for President Obama, and others. But his particular variant of that public choice school was the Virginia School of Political Economy, and he was always preoccupied with critiquing democracy as it existed in his early years, and then ultimately with prescribing measures by which it could be, in his words, enchained. And it was those ideas that Charles Koch picked up.
And what did Koch do to fund Buchanan? Can you talk a bit about the network of organizations and think tanks that Koch has set up?
Yes. Well, Koch, for years, was the single biggest funder on the radical libertarian right by a long stretch. So anybody who was on the libertarian right and looking for money went to Charles Koch. Now, James Buchanan, from his first years in Virginia in the late 1950s, had also broader corporate backing from some of the corporations often associated with the radical anti-New Deal right, you know, some of the fossil fuel companies, General Electric, and so forth. But by the late 1990s, 1997 in particular, Koch had become very frustrated with the inability of his minoritarian cause to make progress, and so he began to invest in a big way in Buchanan's center at the George Mason University. And since then, the center at George Mason has become the kind of academic base camp of this radical right. So the economics department there, something called the Mercatus Center, and the now renamed Scalia School of Law are all important components in the Koch-backed effort to transform the country. And they've actually become pipeline, and Koch asked for this. He wanted a kind of talent pipeline. He always said that their greatest problem was the shortage of talent. And so what they're doing is setting up institutions, little training centers at various other schools modeled on this George Mason case, where they churn out and train young operatives to go off and staff the various pieces of the apparatus, which now is huge. I mean, it is literally dozens and dozens of organizations, actually hundreds if you take into account all the affiliates of the State Policy Network and the international affiliates of something called the Atlas Network. So this is a huge operation, larger than either political party, and quite determined to effect radical change in our country.
What is Koch, you know, who I think you write is the seventh most wealthy person in America, what is Koch and his cohorts, what is their vision of a future society?
Well, it's very interesting what they say when they're trying to put their vision out popularly. Is they talk a lot about liberty. They sometimes even now call themselves the freedom movement. They talk about limited government and low taxes. But if you actually look at the works that most influenced Koch in his construction of that vision, and you look at what some of the people say in their own words our country would look like after success, what you see is an America that would be unrecognizable to your listeners. It's a place in which the three functions of government are maintaining the national defense, overseeing the rule of law, and ensuring social order. And beyond that, we are individually responsible for all of our needs. So ultimately, in their dream world, we have no Social Security, we have no Medicare, we have no public education. What we have instead is a great pressure for us to save as soon as we are sentient beings for our own future needs. And if we fail to save and fail to provide for them, then tough luck. We will be examples to others of what happens when you do not save. And I think you're seeing an enactment, if you will, of this vision in the discussion over health care. And, you know, Americans of both parties are wondering why it is that the Senate is, you know, rushing to push through the repeal of Obamacare and it held, you know, they've had different incarnations, but basically proposed policies that don't get more than 20% support in any poll. Usually it's about 12. They don't have majority support in any state in the country. And it's horrible in the view of most Americans. And yet the donor class is putting pressure on these Republican politicians to make them toe the line or they will face a primary challenge, and forcing them to vote for something that their own constituents don't want. So it's actually gone so far, this transformation of the Republican Party into a delivery vehicle, that that party is pushing through the agenda of its wealthiest, most extreme right donor class rather than it's the voters whose support it needs to continue as a political party.
Well, they've targeted the state. Trump's main advisor, Steve Bannon, has said that he wants to destroy the state. One of his allies, Grover Norquist, famously said that he wants to shrink the government down to the size that it's so small that it can be drowned in a bathtub. What is their strategy to take down the liberal state?
Well, that is where Buchanan's ideas came in. And whereas other people in this, some of your listeners might refer to them as neoliberal, others free market fundamentalists, whereas others in that milieu, like Milton Friedman and Friedrich Hayek, concentrated more on making the case for free markets, James Buchanan spent his career making the case against government and basically trying to take down, in his words, the understanding of public interest that prevailed at mid-century, the idea that all politicians should be seeking the public interest and all political actors, and then we'd try to persuade one another of our case for what that public interest was. And Buchanan instead looked at the incentives in politics. And so he focused particularly on how different groups made demands on public officials, or, also corporations, made demands on public officials and elected officials, and those elected officials, in his terms, would have a self-interest in re-election so that they would try to, appease multiple constituencies without worrying about the cost. And so he did have a very original interpretation of where deficits came from. Now, what the Koch team has done is taken his ideas and turned them into a strategy for kind of retrofitting American government. So the first part of that is to break down all the progressive groups that made demands on the state that would lead to taxation and any transfer of resources from one, section of the population to another. So all the radical attacks we've seen on unions in the last few years fall into this pattern. They're also attacking the American Association of Retirement People and trying to stir young people up against older people to say older people are getting money as they shouldn't. So lots of efforts to break up groups. Also to privatize public resources and services. So they want to privatize ultimately social, in the name, they're saying reform, but they're not questioned about what they mean about that. But what they really ultimately want is the privatization of Social Security and Medicare, public lands, all the rest. And they want to do a whole series of radical policy changes that we probably don't have time for. But the key thing to know is they also want to lock those changes into constitutional amendments, both at the state level and the federal level. So they're actually pushing toward a constitutional convention, which we have not seen in this country since 1787, achieve what the donor class would like to achieve and cannot achieve through the regular political process. And they've actually been extremely successful in gaining control of state governments. They now have full control over 25 states, both houses of the legislature and the governorship. And they're using those states to, in a sense, kind of trap the federal government and prevent the federal government from enacting workable progressive reforms, as they did with the Affordable Care Act, with not accepting Medicaid expansion. So it's a pretty radical vision. It's extremely strategic. And I argue in the book that you can't understand this strategy or its code without understanding the ideas of this guy, James McGill Buchanan.
Nancy, you made the statement that, quote, both my research and my observations as a citizen lead me to believe American democracy is in peril. Can you talk a bit about that? And is that why you wrote this wonderful book?
Yes. I feel like, in some ways, all of what I've been saying kind of points to that conclusion that our democracy is in peril. And you can see this in many ways. I mean, I live in North Carolina now, one of the states that has been a laboratory for this, and it has just been utterly, radically transformed by this cause. And we could also point to things that we haven't talked about yet, like the extreme voter suppression bills, which they also want to lock into the Constitution at a constitutional convention. Voter suppression, extreme gerrymandering, refusal to abide by customary procedures in terms of transparency and full disclosure and proper hearings and so forth. It is just such a radical vision. And, I know maybe some of your listeners will think that I am, Chicken Little or something, and that it couldn't possibly be that bad. And there I just have to say that I was, as I was researching this book, so often I would just discover another wing of this, a deeper set of connections, and literally feel nausea, you know, as I was going through the sources or, you know, going through these websites. It just at the scope of this thing, it is huge, and it is very determined, it is very strategic, and I don't think people on the left adequately understand that at all. There's too much mocking of Trump's tweets and his foibles and his intelligence and so forth when this thing is really, really moving forward, and moving forward at an incredible pace in his administration while people are focused on his tweets and, again, his foibles. So, yes, I absolutely wrote this book as I did, in the way that I did, and in the speed that I did, because I really believe that we are at one of those forks in the roads that will determine what kind of society we will be for the next several generations. It is, in my mind, akin to the Civil War and Reconstruction, to the Great Depression of the 1930s, to the struggles of the 1960s, you know, whether the forces who believe in robust and inclusive democracy will come through this stronger, or whether those who believe in restricting the electorate, that democracy is a danger to private property, and that we need a more actually harsh government, whether they will succeed is we can't know right now. It will all depend on what people do. But I will say the single most important lesson that I hope that people take from reading my book is that this cause, this Koch-backed libertarian cause, is doing what it's doing in the ways that it's doing it because they know from repeated experience that they will never persuade a majority of their views. And so they have to go at it in this side way, what Koch has called the technology of transformation. And I think that if the vast majority of Americans understood what this cause wants, and if they understand what it wants and they reactivate their kind of civic institutions, turn off their electronics and commit to the political process, then I think that this cause will be defeated because, again, it is a small minority, but it's an extremely wealthy and determined and ideological minority.
We've been speaking with Nancy McLean, a professor at Duke, who wrote the terrific book, Democracy in Chains, The Deep History of the Radical Right's Stealth Plan for America. Nancy, I can't tell you how grateful Heidi and I are for your good work on this, and we're so pleased to be able to interview you. I wanted to ask you about Gloria Steinem had observed after Trump was elected and put all these people into cabinet positions, all these far-right people. She said that he found a fox for every chicken coop.
And, that's a brilliant quote.
And that's certainly true. And I wanted your reaction to the nature of the cabinet and how it relates to the Koch project.
Yes. That is just a perfect quote and vintage Steinem, and it really captures the situation. There is actually less light, I think, between the Koch operations and the Trump administration than we've been led to believe. At the very minimum, he is looking to them for so many of his top appointments. The people who are in pivotal places come out of these, not out of the mainstream of the Republican Party, to the extent that there is a mainstream anymore, but what they would call the Republican establishment, but rather out of these Koch-led operations, which I said, you know, there are now, you know, dozens and dozens of these, but there are some particularly key ones, and those key ones have supplied many of Trump's senior leaders. By one researcher's calculation, about 70% of Trump's senior appointees come from these Koch operations, are veterans of it. So that's a pretty stunning figure for what was once a kind of a marginal part of the political spectrum. But they include certainly Mike Pence, his vice presidential candidate, who's deeply rooted in these operations. They include Mark Short, who is his the White House liaison to Congress, who's a key pivot person for legislation, and he actually comes out of Freedom Partners, which was the, you know, is the big dark money operation that the Koch, you know, donor network that the Kochs have run. So he knows very well what the donors want, and presumably can convey that to Congress. Who else? Scott Pruitt at the EPA is deeply, you know, involved, has been deeply involved in these Koch operations, and particularly their, you know, fossil fuel protection work and efforts to prevent any action on climate change. Even Mike Pompeo, the head of the CEO, comes out of these Kansas operations. Certainly Chris Kobach, who's directing the new voter suppression effort. I mean, the list just goes on and on. It is really, really striking how many key people. Mick Mulvaney, the budget director, is another one. So this is really an administration that is, in many ways, I would say, other than perhaps the president himself, a dream administration for the Kochs to achieve their agenda. Oh, and you mentioned Steve Bannon before and his desire to, as he puts it, deconstruct the administrative state. Well, somebody who represents that project in the Scalia School of Law at George Mason, Naomi Rao, was just named to a key agency that most citizens won't pay attention to, but is extremely important for regulation, and that is the Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs, OIRA. So, yes, there is definitely a fox presiding over every chicken coop.
Nancy,
and Betsy DeVos, we didn't even talk about her.
Nancy, speaking of dark money, a number of reviewers have placed your book as the companion to Jane Mayer's Dark Money. Do you think this is accurate?
Well, I'm honored by the comparison. Jane Mayer has done hugely important work as a journalist for the American people in first drawing our attention to the Koch brothers in her articles for The New Yorker some years ago. She wrote a brilliant article about my own state, North Carolina, called State for Sale, that focused on the Koch partner, Art Pope, who has led the effort within North Carolina. And her book is terrific at just, you know, showing readers that money trail and all of the things that it is funding. So I'm honored to be in that company, and I see my work as providing the story of the ideas behind this effort and how they have evolved over time, and also helping people to understand the mid-century Southern roots of all of this, that really the dream vision of this cause is, in a sense, to take us back to mid-century Virginia, I say, minus the segregation, and mid-century Virginia was the most oligarchic state in the country with extreme voter suppression, extreme gerrymandering, you know, a parsimonious provision for public needs despite its wealth, starving public school system, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I have the story of the ideas and also of the legal angle, which is all important to understanding this, and also what the ultimate end game of these ideas is. So yes, I have been many ordinary readers are connecting Jane Mayer and I in their communications, and I'm flattered by the connection.
Nancy, your book, Democracy Unchained, has become an intellectual flashpoint. And you've been subjected to a torrent of abuse for that. For example, I understand that Jonah Goldberg, a senior editor at the National Review, threatened you, writing that you should worry about the, quote, libertarian super posse on my ass. What is the method of operation of the right-wingers who are going after you?
Yeah, it's very interesting. You know, I actually predicted in the book, I said, you know, in the later chapters, and I pointed to the case of Jane Mayer and climate scientists who have brought inconvenient truth to the public for this cause and been subjected to various efforts to smear them. So, you know, it's all... I felt that it was predictable and that I should anticipate it because this is how this cause plays, and their willingness to abuse power is part of my thesis. So, in a sense, they're confirming it. But still, it is pretty stunning to see how deeply the contemporary right has degraded our public discourse, you know, in quotes like the one that you read, you know, coming from the senior editor of a you know, widely read publication. And it's also kind of shocking how intellectually irresponsible so many are, in the sense that most of the people who started critiquing my book, by their own admission, had not read the book. Or if they had read something, they'd found one piece that they might know about to try to, you know, impugn my credibility. So, to be honest, I don't really take them that seriously. I think they're proving to the American people the thesis that I argue in the book about how anti-democratic this cause is, and I'm much more engaged with the real readers who have responded so well to the book and to the, you know, various kinds of mainstream publications, from The Atlantic to The Guardian to Slate to New Republic to I can't even keep track of them all, Alternet, you know, many others have have actually, their reviewers have read the book, engaged the book, and been excited by it. And those are the people I really care to reach and to talk with.
Nancy, James Buchanan actually traveled to Chile after the military coup in 1973 to advise General Augusto Pinochet's military dictatorship after the Chilean military, with instigation and aid from the American government, overthrew the democratically elected government of socialist Salvador Allende. Buchanan helped with suggestions on the economy and on how the dictatorship's constitution could be change so that it would make it very hard to abolish some of the clauses in the Constitution that enshrined private property. Do the far-right Republicans today want to change the American Constitution?
Yes, I believe that they do. And, yeah, it's very interesting. When Milton Friedman went, you know, the Nixon administration was still in power, and the Nixon administration had aided in the coup. By the time that James Buchanan went, Pinochet had carried out an assassination in the streets of Washington, D.C. It was an international pariah. You know, the news of the brutality of the dictatorship had become common knowledge, and it was in that point in 1980 that Buchanan went to advise on this new constitution with which the dictatorship could get the radical changes that it wanted and had effected while under a military junta, so it could get those radical changes perpetuated after a transition to civilian rule, which the whole international community was pushing for. So Buchanan's contribution was arguably much more permanent and lasting and chilling in my mind. In any event, yes, the perceived success that the right enjoyed in Chile, and particularly, again, this neoliberal, if you want to call them right, I call them the property supremacist right, you can think about them in different ways, but they were pleased by what happened in Chile, and that is absolutely what they're trying to bring to the United States and, frankly, to other parts of the world as well. Buchanan said at one point that no constitution in the world protected the rights of the minority, and by that he always really meant the wealthy minority, adequately. And by that measure, all existing constitutions are failures. Now, you got to think about that. No place in the world captures your ideal. So this is like a radical utopian libertarian right, but because of this billionaire power that is behind it and its capacity to hire, you know, literally thousands of operatives to move this agenda, it is on the verge of radically transforming our institutions and our legal system. So, yes, they have invested mightily in changing the law through the various, you know, the kind of law and economics programs to undermine the case for regulation, through constitutional, investing in constitutional scholars who would want to bring us back to, you know, what legal scholars would call the Lochner era, what I also remember as the Plessy era, a time of extreme dominance of capital and extreme suppression of democracy. And they are beginning to achieve that bit by bit around the country. They're talking about putting, you know, voter ID in the federal constitution, putting balanced budget amendments in the federal constitution so as to undermine, you know, programs like Social Security and Medicare. You could just go on. I mean, they have at least 10 different amendments that they want to get through if they get this constitutional convention. And because of their control over state, so many state governments, you know, while the eyes of the left were focused on Washington and various personalities, because of that structural power, they are, by their own lights, close to success.
I think that the other alarming success they've had is in the legal system and the kind of judges that they're getting appointed, the last one being Neil Gorsuch. But if they stack that, then we're really in trouble.
And can I just add, Michael, that was actually a product of the Federalist Society, who groomed students for decades, conservative, to have them placed in judicial positions and higher up positions.
And you won't be surprised to know at this point that Koch was an early funder of that effort.
Exactly.
Yes.
Right.
Yes, and has funded the Institute for Justice. And a lot of these organizations that seem so marginal in their legal thinking, that I think many legal scholars don't take them seriously, but again, because of the power they've achieved and the fact that they've been able to get cases to the Supreme Court and score some significant victories, they are really important to watch. And another thing, actually, that I think is important for people to know is that this this Koch-led libertarian cause has also politicized, is also working to politicize judicial elections and to pump unheard-of amounts of cash into state judicial races to ensure that the state courts sign off on the radical changes that they're making in policies in states like, again, my own North Carolina. So, again, this is highly strategic. It is very well thought out. There are people playing a long game with a very frightening end game, and it behooves all of us to understand it as best we can.
I wanted to ask you, on a personal note, if we might, how did you get political, and how would you define your politics?
Well, I got political. I was, you know, I was born in 1959, and so I was a child, you know, when the civil rights movement was on television and the war in Vietnam was on television, and I was a reader, and so I was always, you know, moved by things. But my first activism was in college when apartheid was in place in South Africa, and there was an anti-apartheid movement on campuses, and that was the first thing that really made me wake up and say, wow, this is wrong, you know, I need to do something. So I've always, you know, been a progressive person. I believe in democracy deeply. I believe in fairness, and that keeps me going and connecting to people who are also working for those things through writing this book has just been a source of joy. I mean, I can't tell you how many great people in the trenches or who are starting to pay attention to politics who hadn't before and who are reading the book and writing to me, how energizing that is. I feel like there's a great kind of weariness in America right now, I think, with people having felt bullied and having felt like their system is changing and it's not responsive and they don't understand why. And as they start to understand what's happening and why, more and more people are finding ways to get involved and to try to challenge this and to reverse this. And so so that's just been really exciting to me. I just love to see grassroots leadership and people finding their voices. That's very sustaining for me.
Very moving, Nancy. Nancy McLean has written a wonderful book, which we heartily recommend to you, called Democracy in Chains, The Deep History of the Radical Right Stealth Plan for America. Nancy, it's just a tremendous contribution you've made. Heidi and I are grateful to you, and we've loved this interview, and we wish you all the luck. Are you going to be on tour? How do people get in touch with you so that we can know if you're speaking somewhere and people can come out and hear you?
Oh, thank you so much, and it has been such a pleasure talking to you guys. You have such an amazing show. If people go to the Penguin Random House book page for Democracy in Chains, they'll see a little orange logo that says On Tour, and the tour spots are starting to be put in there. And it's not a full listing yet, you know, so if you don't see your city represented, you could contact the press or contact me and see if anything is being organized there. But at this point, I'd say we have a couple dozen venues and places in the works, and so hopefully I'll get to an area where I can talk to some of your wonderful listeners.
Nancy, it's been an honor to have you on. Congratulations on a truly remarkable and timely book, Democracy in Chains.
Thank you so much, Heidi, and thank you, Michael.
You take it easy.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. Thank you.
With the recent nomination of conservative attorney Brett Kavanaugh to replace Justice Anthony Kennedy, the U.S. Supreme Court will have a majority of anti-democratic jurists who support a powerful executive. At the same time, Donald Trump has been quick to appoint more conservatives to federal judgeships. More and more, we're hearing that the once little-known Federalist Society is behind these appointments. But that's not new. The Society was formed at Yale University in 1981. It has grown steadily and quietly in placing its attorney members in positions of power, both in the government and in the judiciary. In their 2013 book, The Federalist Society, How Conservatives Took the Law Back from Liberals, attorneys Michael Avery and Danielle McLaughlin trace the movements of this small group of conservative law students and lawyers, and their increasing influence. The Federalist Society has lawyer chapters in every major city in the U.S. and student chapters in every accredited law school. Members include economic conservatives, social conservatives, Christian conservatives, and even libertarians. One of the things that has made the Federalist Society so very effective is their big picture agenda. While they may have differences of opinion on a range of issues, they have successfully put those aside to advance a far-reaching, long-lasting, and broad conservative agenda. This agenda includes chipping away at social gains made since the 1930s. Medicare and Medicaid and Social Security are on the block. So is Roe v. Wade and Citizens United, holding that corporations are persons and that money is free speech, as well as the union-breaking Janus decision. These are just the beginning. Other attacks on democracy include voter suppression, voter ID laws, and gerrymandering. Joining us now to discuss the recent shift in the Supreme Court and to update us on the Federalist Society is attorney Michael Avery. Michael is the former president of the National Lawyers Guild, and he's an expert in the areas of constitutional law and police misconduct. Welcome back to Law and Disorder, Michael.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Michael, can you tell our listeners a little bit about the Federalist Society?
The Federalist Society has been around since 1982, when they had their first conference in New Haven at Yale Law School in April of that year. Conservative law students who were upset because they felt that the law in general and the academy in particular was biased toward liberals started speaking out and organizing. And what was remarkable about it was just within a very few weeks after their first conference, they began to organize chapters at other schools, and they grew very, very fast. They had an infusion of money from the Olin Foundation. They were off and running. When those students graduated, Edwin Meese, who was President Reagan's initially his White House counselor and then his attorney general, recognized the value of these young conservatives and immediately gave them important jobs in the White House and in the Department of Justice. And that really started the organization off with a bang.
Now, you've been interested in them for several years. In fact, your book came out in 2013. What triggered your initial interest?
Well, I had been reading about the Federalist Society and learning a little bit about them. But I realized that most people didn't know who they were, didn't know what they were up to, what they believed in, where their money came from. But at the same time, they had enormous influence. They had the White House counselor to George H.W. Bush when he was president was C. Boyden Gray, who later became a trustee of the Federalist Society. Working for Gray was Lee Lieberman Otis, one of the founders. And she was, in fact, vetting judges for the first President Bush. So I saw that behind the scenes, they had great power, but publicly, almost no one knew about them. And so I thought they were a good subject for research and writing.
Now, one of the things that your book discusses and that I think is a key to their really multi-generational success is the fact that they don't quibble over specific issues and internal differences, but they look really at the long picture. Can you talk a bit about that?
Well, the Federalist Society is a big tent, and they have conservatives of all stripes, from the religious right, business conservatives, libertarians, all gathered together. Now, of course, these folks have many disagreements among themselves, but unlike the left, they have agreed to disagree. And so they get everybody in this big tent, and they cooperate on what they can cooperate on, and they help each other push their agendas forward, even if they might have disagreements about specifics from time to time.
In terms of the landscape of the federal courts, how have the appointments influenced that over the last couple of decades?
Well, the Republican presidents have understood very well the importance of judicial appointments. Edwin Meese, Ronald Reagan's White House counselor and later attorney general, said that a president has no greater impact on history than he does through his appointment of judges. The Federalist Society took that to heart. Their early view was, we'll change the law by changing the judges. And they started that in the Reagan administration when George H.W. Bush was president. They had people in the White House basically advising him on judicial selection, including one of the founders of the Federalist Society, Lee Lieberman Otis. When W. Bush was president, Brett Kavanaugh, who's now been nominated to the Supreme Court for the first 2 years of W. Bush's presidency, Brett Kavanaugh picked judges for him in the White House. So they have infiltrated the selection process for many, many years, and that has resulted in judges who favor big business, dislike government regulation, dislike environmental laws, dislike laws that favor consumers. They are friendly to the church. They have allowed a greater degree of state support for religion than we've ever seen in this country. They oppose affirmative action. They don't think race should be taken into account in selecting people for colleges or jobs. In the international sphere, that's one area where they're completely aligned with Mr. Trump, which is America first. They believe very much in American exceptionalism, that we're different, that we're better, that we don't have to follow the rules that other people have to follow. And so really the whole package is something that they've been able to bring into policy through judicial decisions.
It seems as though these judges are the real activists, a term that the conservatives use so often to describe liberals.
Oh, no question about it. The Rehnquist Court struck down many more laws than really most courts had since going back to before the New Deal. You know, judicial activism is merely a rhetorical device to describe something that a judge does that the speaker doesn't like. Everybody who gets appointed to the Supreme Court says that judges don't make law, but anybody who goes to law school knows that judges do make law.
Can you talk a bit about the originalist theory of jurisprudence and how it's employed in the service of a right-wing agenda?
What the Federalist Society people have promoted, going back, again, Meese was a big proponent of this, Stephen Calabresi wrote a book about it, is the notion that we should interpret the Constitution according to the meaning that the words in it had in the 18th century. And that originally their idea was, you know, the intent of the framers of the Constitution, but they've kind of moved beyond the idea of original intent to the idea of original meaning. That we can go back and look at what words meant at the time and through that understand what the framers of the Constitution meant in what they were saying. The late Justice Scalia was major proponent of this way of thinking. And of course, that's a conservative view, because one of the things that's happened since the 17th century is that our society has embraced individual rights much more than used to be the case. The Federalist Society is much more interested in property rights, whereas the National Lawyers Guild is more interested in human rights.
Michael, I'm assuming that with the new complexion of the Supreme Court, we're going to just see more and more of what you referenced in terms of valuing property rights, corporations, and chiseling away at individual rights.
Yes. I mean, we could describe the Roberts Court already as the business court. Now, with the addition of Gorsuch and Kavanaugh, these folks believe that the most important right protected by the Constitution is the right of rich people to do whatever they want with their property. You know, protecting property rights if you have property and if you're rich, but if you're an ordinary person, individual rights are much more important to you. And that's what groups like the National Lawyers Guild have put ahead of property rights. Human rights is the thing that we're concerned about. I think what we have to worry about now is that that's going to be cut back, and we're going to be, again, as we were before the New Deal, in an era of social Darwinism.
Well, they say that history goes in cycles, and we used to say in the Guild, bad times for the country are good for the Guild, in that we saw resurgence of activism and support for the kind of work that progressive groups were doing. What is your greatest fear right now for the country? Do you think that we're going to see an upsurge in people taking to the streets and protesting?
You know, I don't know if we are or not. People have been so beaten down. People don't have the health care they need. They don't have the jobs they need. A lot of people in this country don't have the basic nutrition that they need. So I'm concerned about that. My biggest fear is that America is in the waning days of the Roman Empire, and that everything that this country enjoyed when it was taking advantage of the rest of the world and exploiting Latin America and having its way with markets in Asia is coming to an end. And at the last moment, the capitalist class and the people with power and influence are fighting tooth and nail to hang on to what they have. And with an egomaniac like President Trump in power, I just think the risks, not only for our country but for the world, of war that we won't recover from are very great.
Right. You know, Michael, because of your experience and background in police misconduct, I'm always struck when Trump is so critical of our national intelligence agencies that his supporters are going to lose respect for those institutions. I'm not saying they're not flawed, but what do you see as the damage internally when we have a lack of respect for those agencies that are tasked with really safeguarding national security intelligence issues, given our precarious relationship right now with all the other nations?
That's complicated because we don't have much respect for those agencies to begin with. and the idea of invoking national security is something that the government usually uses to put down its internal critics. To my mind, what's going on here is that there is some relationship between President Trump and Putin and the Russians that has not yet been fully ventilated. We don't know exactly what it is. We don't know exactly what his game is. But it was interesting to me that former President Obama, speaking in South Africa, was talking about the rise of powerful leaders ignoring the wishes of their constituents, and that's kind of what we see on this stage with Trump and Putin.
Right.
So I think Trump's criticism of the intelligence agencies is part of an internal game that he's running to enhance his own power, at the expense of, really, of the rule of law.
Right. And then, of course, his selection of Supreme Court justices are individuals that we expect are going to support a strong executive that will sort of worsen that problem.
Well, Kavanaugh has written about that. Judge Kavanaugh wrote an article in which he said he didn't think a sitting president should be prosecuted criminally, that the only, you know, the only remedy that you have for something that a president might do would be impeachment. And we know that impeachment is impossible as long as the president's party controls the House and the Senate. So, you know, it's a willingness to thumb your nose at the rule of law for the sake of having a powerful president. And I think that's very dangerous.
Michael, we just have a couple of minutes left. Any thoughts on whether Roe v. Wade will be overturned?
I think Roe v. Wade may well be overturned. It has been irritating to the conservatives since the Rehnquist Court that despite all the Republican precedents we've had, that they haven't been able to overturn Roe v. Wade. And so I'm afraid that may well be at great risk now. On the other hand, I would not like to see the debate over Kavanaugh reduced simply to concern about Roe v. Wade. As important as Roe v. Wade is and as important as the right of women to have that autonomy is, there are so many other issues on the table that Kavanaugh's appointment is going to affect that I think we just need to keep our eye across the entire board of things that we need to be concerned about. Someone asked me the other day, why is it that when students organized in the 60s and there was a big movement of blacks and whites across a wide spectrum of issues, anti-war, anti-poverty, civil rights, why didn't that result in those organizations coming to power the way the Federalist Society has come to power? And I think the answer to that is that it's important to realize that the Federalist Society was invited into the government. It was invited in by President Reagan. It was invited in by both Bushes. It's been invited in by President Trump. The left-wing organizations have never been invited into the government and are never going to be invited into the government. If we're organizing on the left for people's power, for progressive issues, we have to recognize from the beginning that we have a much, much more difficult task than the right does when it seeks power. Because even when the Democrats are in power, they are a middle-of-the-road, centrist political organization that doesn't want to invite the left in, doesn't want the kind of changes that we want. So our job is very, very difficult, much more difficult than the job of the right.
That's a really important point. One of the other factors that I've been continually dismayed about is the failure of anyone in leadership to really take a bold stance and, especially in the Trump administration, stand up for what they believe is right. There's so much kowtowing and failure to sort of think outside the box or voice an individual thought. I think we really are suffering from a lack of leadership on many levels.
Well, I think it's the old story of the emperor's new clothes. I think that parable has a lot to teach us today. So somebody needs to have the courage to come out and say the emperor isn't wearing any clothes.
Right.
To tell the truth about Trump. And after his gaffe in Helsinki 2 days ago, some of the Republicans started criticizing him, but that won't last. I mean, as you say, they don't have the political courage to admit that what he's doing is not just bad for Democrats, it's bad for everybody.
Michael, your book was ahead of its time, The Federalist Society, How Conservatives Took the Law Back from Liberals. How can people get a hold of it? Because it's important reading.
They can get it on the Vanderbilt University Press website, which will route them to Amazon and Barnes & Noble and, you know, all the major sellers.
They could go to individual bookstores and order a copy.
Absolutely.
Which would be good.
And we'd love to see them do so.
Right. And what are you working on now, Michael, if there's anything you'd like to share?
Well, I'm continuing my work on police misconduct. Every year I update, along with my co-authors, the treatise that we publish for lawyers. And the thing I'm dismayed at this year is that I read all the cases that have been decided in the last year by the courts of appeals that deal with police misconduct. And this year, I'm shocked at how many police killings of civilians I'm reading about. I mean, it's way more than it has been in the past. That just is a statistic that seems to be climbing. I know people are concerned about it, but we really have to find an effective way of doing something about it.
Are you still involved in the National Police Accountability Project?
Yes, I am. I'm on the board, and I'm on the executive committee of the board.
Well, Michael, it's always a pleasure to have you on. You have such open-minded political perspective and foresight, and we hope that people will run out and get a copy of the Federalist Society, because we're going to be seeing more of the blueprint that they created several decades ago.
Thank you, Heidi. It's always a pleasure to be on Law and Disorder.
All right. Have a great day, Michael.
You too.
Bye-bye.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org.
Thank you. WRCT Pittsburgh, we won't respect you in the morning.
And I'm Mary.
From high
places.
And you're listening to WRCT.
88.3 FM.
FM.
A radio.
Imperialism inevitably is accompanied, it's the Siamese twin, they're inseparable, by militarism. Militarism is not the defense of the country. Militarism is vested interests in the standing army. George Washington, in his famous farewell address, spoke of the dangers of standing armies, that they were an enemy of liberty and particularly of Republican liberty, he said. What he had in mind, Washington was not an isolationist, what he had in mind is that the maintenance of a standing army inevitably draws power away from the Congress and the courts toward the imperial presidency.
That's Chalmers Johnson, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. Welcome to an AR classic featuring Chalmers Johnson on Blowback, Impacts of the New Militarism. The CIA coined the term blowback to describe the unintended results of U.S. covert operations abroad. It was first used in connection with Operation Ajax, the agency's 1953 coup in Iran, overthrowing the democratic government of Mohammad Mossadegh. The United States today has hundreds of military bases around the world. It's a form of domination that greatly expanded under the Bush administration's post-9/11 so-called War on Terror. Supporting a far-flung military empire generates large profits for many U.S. corporations. It's terrific for weapons manufacturers like Lockheed Martin, Raytheon, Boeing, and Northrop Grumman, and for contractors like Halliburton, Dyncor, and Fluor. Not surprisingly, many people from Iraq to Japan are angry with having to live with Uncle Sam in uniform in their backyard. This program features Chalmers Johnson, a distinguished political scientist who passed away in 2010. He was professor emeritus at the University of California, San Diego. He was the author of Blowback, Sorrows of Empire, Nemesis, and Dismantling the Empire. He warned, "A nation can be one or the other, a democracy or an imperialist, but it can't be both. If it sticks to imperialism, it will, like the old Roman Republic, lose its democracy to a domestic dictatorship." Chalmers Johnson gave the following talk in Seattle in 2004.
I thought I would begin tonight with just a quick rundown of the origins of my own American Empire project. Blowback, subtitled The Costs and Consequences of American Empire, was researched and written during 1998, 1999. It was published early in the year 2000. It grew out of two quite specific influences on me. As I say in the front of the book, I had been throughout the Cold War a spear carrier for empire. I believed the Soviet Union was a genuine menace. I was, in that sense, a routine professor of international relations. Two things happened. One was the demise of the Soviet Union in 1991. I expected a much greater peace dividend, a much greater withdrawal of the United States from its elaborate apparatus around the world, military apparatus to confront the Soviet Union. Instead, our government did everything in its power to find a replacement enemy almost at once, and it shored up the old Cold War structures, particularly in East Asia and in Latin America. This struck me analytically as an important development. It raised the question, was the Cold War in fact a cover for something more fundamental? Was the Cold War in fact a way of justifying something that the leaders of our government did not think was fully justifiable, namely an American imperial project going back to World War II and growing out of the demise of the British Empire? As I say, I expected a great deal more. It didn't come, and it required analysis. The second